Here is the transcript for an informative and engaging podcast episode discussing the research paper Automatic Recognition of Gesture Identity and Onset of Cues Speech. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of our podcast, where we dive deep into the most fascinating scientific research. I'm Tom, here with my co-host Jen.
Hi there. Today we are going to be exploring a really intriguing paper that looks at automatic recognition of gestures and speech in a unique communication system called cued speech. The title of the paper is Automatic Recognition of Gesture Identity and Onset of Cued Speech, and it was authored by a team of researchers from the ICM Institute in Paris.
Cued speech is a fascinating topic. It's a visual communication method used by some deaf and hard of hearing communities around the world, where hand gestures are used alongside lip reading to convey spoken language. The gestures represent the different sounds of speech, helping to clarify what's being said when lip reading alone isn't enough.
Exactly. And this paper tackles an important challenge. How can we develop technology to automatically recognize and transcribe these cued speech gestures? The researchers built a new dataset of cued speech videos and used machine learning techniques to try to automatically identify the hand shapes and positions that represent different speech sounds.
That's really cool. So what did they find? Were they able to accurately recognize the cued speech gestures?
Yes, the results are quite impressive. The researchers developed an automated cued speech recognition system that was able to identify the hand gestures with very high accuracy. Specifically, they could recognize the hand shapes with 94.5% accuracy and the hand positions with 97.7% accuracy, using just simple linear classifiers.
Wow, that's remarkable. So how did they achieve such strong performance? What kinds of techniques did they use?
A key part of their approach was focusing on cued speech-specific features. Rather than just feeding raw video data into a neural network, they first extracted detailed information about the hand and face landmarks using a tool called MediaPipe. Then, they computed custom features based on the spatial relationships and movements of these landmarks, things like the distance between the fingertips and the base of the fingers, or the position of the hand relative to the face.
Ah, I see. So they really tried to leverage the unique properties of cued speech to inform their machine learning models. That makes a lot of sense. And what about detecting the actual onset, or starting point, of the gestures? That seems like an important part of transcribing continuous cued speech.
Absolutely, the researchers tackled that challenge as well. They developed a clever method to automatically detect the onset of each cued speech gesture by analyzing the velocity of the hand movements. When the hand slows down and changes direction, that likely corresponds to the start of a new gesture. They combined this velocity information with the output of their gesture recognition models to accurately pinpoint the gesture onsets, with an average error of only 93 milliseconds.
That's really impressive. Being able to automatically detect those gesture onsets must be hugely valuable for doing further analysis on the timing and coordination between the speech sounds and the visual cues.
Exactly. And that's precisely what the researchers went on to explore. They compared the timing of the acoustic onsets of the spoken syllables to the visual onsets of the corresponding cued speech gestures. And they found a really fascinating pattern. On average, the acoustic onset actually precedes the visual onset by about 150 milliseconds.
That's quite a substantial time difference. I wonder why there would be that kind of delay between the speech sounds and the accompanying visual cues?
The researchers dug into that as well. They found that the acoustic-visual time difference was more sensitive to the identity of the consonant in the syllable, rather than the vowel. Certain consonants seem to be more tightly coupled with their corresponding hand gestures than others. It's a really intriguing finding that speaks to the complex coordination between the auditory and visual aspects of cued speech production.
Fascinating. This study is really shedding light on some of the underlying mechanisms and timing dynamics involved in this unique communication modality. I'm impressed by the researchers' multi-pronged approach, not only developing robust automated recognition systems, but also using those systems to gain new scientific insights.
Absolutely. And the fact that they're making their new dataset and tools publicly available is really commendable. It'll open up so many new avenues for further research on cued speech. There's still a lot we have to learn about this fascinating intersection of speech, gesture, and sensory processing.
For sure. This is just the beginning. I can't wait to see what other discoveries emerge as the scientific community builds upon this work. Cued speech is truly a hidden gem when it comes to understanding human communication and language.
Well said. This was a really enlightening dive into an important and understudied area of research. I'm glad we got to share these insights with our listeners today. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Just that I'm continually amazed by the creativity and ingenuity of researchers, and how they can uncover such rich insights by studying unique communication systems like cued speech. There's always more to discover about the remarkable capabilities of the human mind and body.
Couldn't agree more. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time on the podcast. Tom and Jen, goodbye.
Here is a funny and weird commercial for a new company that emerged from the research on automatic recognition of cued speech gestures. Upbeat jingle plays. Are you tired of fumbling around, trying to communicate with your deaf or hard of hearing friends and family?
Introducing QSpeak, the revolutionary new app that translates your speech into intuitive hand gestures in real time. Camera cuts to a person chatting enthusiastically, their hands making strange, robotic movements.
Just speak normally, and QSpeak will automatically generate the corresponding cued speech hand shapes and positions for you.
No more charades, no more pen and paper. QSpeak makes communication a breeze. Dramatic zoom on a person's face as they struggle to understand the robotic hand gestures.
QSpeak, your personal sign language translator, powered by the latest AI technology.
Download QSpeak now for iOS and Android, and start conversing with your hands today.
QSpeak, because who needs words when you've got jazz hands? Funky ending jingle. Here is the podcast transcript for the episode on determinants of persistent PTSD in war-exposed children. Application of a new causal discovery and inference approach in Syrian refugees. Introduction. Hello and welcome to the Cutting Edge Discoveries podcast. I'm your host, Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi there, listeners. In this episode, we'll be diving deep into a fascinating research paper that sheds light on the factors contributing to severe and persistent post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in refugee children.
The paper is titled Determinants of Persistent PTSD in War-Exposed Children. Application of a New Causal Discovery and Inference Approach in Syrian Refugees. It was authored by a team of researchers from the United Kingdom, Brazil, and Lebanon, and it explores the key predictors and potential causes of lasting PTSD in Syrian refugee children living in humanitarian settings.
This is a really important topic, as refugee children are at an incredibly high risk of developing mental health issues like PTSD due to the traumas they've experienced. Understanding the root causes of severe and persistent PTSD is crucial for developing effective interventions and supporting these vulnerable young people.
The researchers used some fascinating new techniques to uncover the drivers of PTSD in this population. Let's dive in and learn more about their findings. Body. The study was conducted as part of the BIOPATH cohort, a large-scale longitudinal investigation of Syrian refugee families living in informal tented settlements in Lebanon. The researchers followed over 1,500 children aged 8 to 16. Collecting data on a wide range of potential risk factors at the individual, family, and community levels.
What's really interesting is that the researchers didn't just rely on standard statistical methods to analyze their data. They employed a cutting-edge approach called causal discovery and inference, which allowed them to model the complex web of causal relationships between different variables and the children's mental health outcomes.
That's right. Rather than just looking at correlations, the causal modeling allowed the researchers to infer the potential causes of persistent and severe PTSD. This is a major advance over traditional epidemiological approaches, which can struggle to disentangle the myriad factors at play in complex mental health issues.
So what did they find? The researchers identified several key factors that emerged as potential causes of severe and persistent PTSD in these refugee children.
First and foremost, the level of exposure to war-related events was a major contributor. The more traumatic experiences the children had faced, the higher their risk of developing lasting, debilitating PTSD symptoms.
Tragically, the children in this study had endured unimaginable horrors. In addition to the violence of war, many had also experienced further victimization, such as peer violence and maltreatment. These forms of victimization were also identified as key predictors of persistent PTSD.
And it wasn't just the children's own experiences that mattered. The mental health of their caregivers played a big role as well. The researchers found that caregiver depression was significantly associated with the child's risk of severe and lasting PTSD.
That makes a lot of sense from an ecological systems perspective. The well-being of the family unit and home environment is so crucial, especially for children who have been through extreme trauma. If the parents are struggling, it can profoundly impact the child's ability to recover and heal.
Absolutely. And the researchers also highlighted another critical factor: the quality of the refugee environment the children were living in at the time of the evaluation. The worse the living conditions, access to services, and overall daily stressors, the higher the child's risk of persistent PTSD.
That's a really important finding. It suggests that while the initial war-related trauma may set the stage for PTSD, the ongoing challenges and adversity faced by refugee children in their current living situation can actually perpetuate and exacerbate the mental health issues.
Exactly. The researchers argue that improving the living conditions and minimizing further violence and victimization in these humanitarian settings could be key to preventing severe and lasting PTSD in refugee children. It's not just about addressing the past trauma, but also the present-day challenges.
That makes so much sense. It really underscores the value of this causal modeling approach. By identifying the most salient drivers of PTSD, the researchers can now provide clear, evidence-based guidance for interventions and policy changes to support these vulnerable youth. Reflections.
I have to say, I'm really impressed by the rigor and innovation of this study. Using causal discovery and inference techniques to unpack the complex web of factors influencing PTSD is such a powerful approach.
Absolutely. It moves us beyond just correlational analyses and allows us to start pinpointing the true causes. Of course, as the researchers acknowledge, establishing definitive causal relationships will require further research. But this is a hugely important first step.
And I'm really struck by how comprehensive their assessment of potential risk factors was. Covering individual, family, and community-level variables, that ecological systems view is so crucial when it comes to understanding mental health outcomes, especially for populations facing such profound adversity.
Totally. They didn't just focus on the obvious trauma-related factors, but really dug into the broader social determinants of health. Things like housing quality, access to services, caregiver mental health, those contextual factors can make all the difference in how children are able to cope and recover.
Absolutely. And I think one of the other strengths of this study is how they validated their findings through that subsample of clinical interviews. Being able to confirm the PTSD diagnoses and severity levels really lends credibility to the results.
Definitely. It's not just relying on self-report measures, but actually getting that clinical assessment. That adds an important layer of rigor and ensures we can trust the outcomes they're identifying as being truly representative of severe, persistent PTSD.
Definitely. This is the kind of innovative, multifaceted research that I think is going to be so crucial for supporting refugee mental health in the years to come. By unpacking the causal mechanisms at play, we can start to develop much more targeted and effective interventions. Conclusion.
Absolutely. The key takeaways from this study are that minimizing ongoing stressor, addressing caregiver mental health, and preventing further violence and victimization could be critical strategies for mitigating severe and persistent PTSD in war-exposed refugee children.
Yes, and the researchers have really provided a roadmap for how to identify those highest-risk kids so they can receive the intensive, specialized support they need. It's about so much more than just addressing the initial trauma. It's about creating an environment that fosters healing and resilience.
Exactly. This is such vital, cutting-edge work, and I'm really excited to see how it helps shape the future of mental health care and support for refugee populations around the world. There's still so much to learn, but studies like this are pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
Couldn't agree more. This has been a fascinating deep dive into an incredibly important piece of research. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next time on Cutting Edge Discoveries.
Bye for now.
Utopian Society's commercial. Are you a refugee child struggling with severe, persistent PTSD? Feeling hopeless and stuck in a cycle of trauma?
Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing the brand new Resilience Reward System from Utopian Societies, Inc.
Utopian Societies, Inc. has cracked the code on healing trauma in war-exposed kids. Our cutting-edge Resilience Reward System uses the latest causal discovery and inference technology to identify your unique triggers and tailor a one-of-a-kind treatment plan.
That's right. Through a patented combination of virtual reality exposure therapy, family counseling, and a state-of-the-art reward chip implanted directly into your brain, we guarantee a 200% reduction in PTSD symptoms or your money back. Asterisk.
No more relying on unreliable caregivers or unstable living conditions. Our Resilience Reward System puts you, the traumatized child, in the driver's seat of your own mental health recovery.
Earn points for managing your anxiety, facing your fears, and maintaining a positive attitude. Cash those points in for cool prizes like fidget spinners, ice cream coupons, or even a free trip to our all-inclusive Utopian Refugee Resort.
Don't settle for subpar PTSD treatment. Call 1-800-RESILIENT now to get started on your path to a trauma-free future. Because at Utopian Societies, Inc., we're building a better world, one rewarded refugee at a time.
Asterisk. Terms and conditions apply. May cause nausea, migraines, and an insatiable craving for Skittles. Side effects include sudden bursts of joy, uncontrollable laughter, and a creeping sense of ennui. Call your doctor if symptoms persist for more than 4 hours.
Here is an informative, entertaining, and detailed podcast episode about the research paper How Displacement Might Have Evolved. Hello and welcome to Uncovering the Unexpected, the podcast that dives deep into cutting-edge research, unearthing fascinating discoveries and unraveling their secrets. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. In this episode, we'll be exploring a paper that delves into the evolutionary origins of one of the core features of human language, displacement.
Displacement is the incredible ability we have to talk about things and events that are not present in the here and now. It's what allows us to reminisce about the past, plan for the future, and imagine entirely new possibilities.
Exactly. This remarkable capacity sets human language apart from the communication systems of other species. But where did it come from? That's the question this intriguing paper aims to answer.
The paper is titled How Displacement Might Have Evolved, and it's authored by Elizabeth Ching Zhang, Edward Royong Shi, and Antonio Benitez Baraco. They take a deep dive into the neurobiological foundations of displacement, proposing a novel evolutionary pathway for how this uniquely human ability emerged.
This is fascinating stuff. The researchers don't just look at displacement itself, but trace its origins back to changes in specific brain regions, the hippocampus, basal ganglia, thalamus, and parietal cortex. They argue these neurological developments, driven in part by our trend towards greater prosociality, or self-domestication, ultimately enabled our advanced capacity for mental time travel and episodic memory.
Right. And those cognitive abilities are so crucial for displacement and, by extension, the generative power of human language. The authors make a really compelling case for how this positive feedback loop between neurobiology, memory, imagination, and language could have unfolded over the course of human evolution.
It's a beautifully interdisciplinary approach, blending insights from fields like neuroscience, evolutionary biology, and linguistics. Let's dive into the details. Where does the story begin?
Well, the researchers start by situating displacement within the broader context of language evolution. They note that while displacement is considered a hallmark of human language, its exact relationship to language is still not entirely clear. After all, the ability to think and communicate about things beyond the immediate context is not unique to language. It's also tied to our general capacities for mental time travel and spatial navigation.
Interesting. So displacement isn't just a linguistic phenomenon, but reflects broader cognitive faculties. The paper then explores how these abilities may have evolved, contrasting two main perspectives.
Exactly. On one side, some researchers have argued that the emergence of full-fledged, Recursive language is what enabled our enhanced abilities for displacement. The idea is that language's generative power, powered by the computational mechanism of merge, allowed us to conceive of and communicate about endless possible scenarios.
And on the other hand, researchers like the cognitive psychologist Michael Corbolas have proposed the opposite, that it was the evolution of more sophisticated mental time travel abilities that ultimately gave rise to the generativity of human language. In this view, language developed as a medium to share these rich mental experiences with others.
Right. So there's an interesting chicken and egg debate around the relationship between language and displacement. But the authors of this paper say we can shed light on this by taking a bottom-up approach and examining the neurobiological underpinnings.
That's a really smart move. Looking at the brain regions involved can give us crucial clues about how displacement may have emerged. So what did the researchers find?
They identify four key brain areas that stand out as central to supporting our capacity for displacement and mental time travel: the hippocampus, basal ganglia, thalamus, and parietal cortex. Let's start with the hippocampus.
The hippocampus is often considered the hub of episodic memory, allowing us to vividly recall past events. The researchers explained that this region plays a crucial role in integrating diverse sensory information into coherent spatiotemporal representations. It's almost like the hippocampus acts as a computational device, rapidly binding together the what, where, and when of our experiences.
Exactly. And this relational, generative capability of the hippocampus has been directly linked to the recursive nature of language. In fact, the paper cites research showing the hippocampus is involved in all sorts of language functions, from grammar learning to semantic processing.
Fascinating. So the hippocampus seems to be this pivotal interface between memory, imagination, and language. And the authors suggest similar stories emerge when you look at the other key brain regions.
Absolutely. The basal ganglia, for instance, have been strongly implicated in procedural memory and the automation of rule-governed aspects of language, like syntax. There's also evidence they play a role in episodic memory retrieval.
The thalamus is another crucial hub, acting as a relay station that modulates cortical and subcortical activity. The authors highlight how specific thalamic nuclei contribute to consolidating offline memories and processing spatial and temporal information, functions integral to displacement.
And finally, the parietal cortex emerges as key for integrating multisensory inputs, which is vital for the formation and recall of episodic memories. Lesion studies in animals have shown deficits in spatial navigation and future-oriented decision-making when this region is damaged.
So in summary, we have this core neural network, the hippocampus, basal ganglia, thalamus, and parietal cortex, that seems to underpin our uniquely human capacities for mental time travel, episodic memory, and the kind of displacement we see in language. But how did these systems evolve?
That's where the researchers' hypothesis about human self-domestication comes into play. They argue that the trend in our lineage towards increased prosociality and reduced aggression, a process akin to the domestication of animals, may have been a key driver of the changes in these brain regions.
Ah, that's a fascinating idea. We know domestication can impact brain structure and function in animals, often in ways that enhance memory, learning, and social cognition. So the authors are proposing a similar dynamic played out in human evolution.
Exactly. For instance, the hippocampus of domesticated species often shows structural and functional changes compared to their wild counterparts. And this seems to be linked to differences in spatial navigation, memory, and even stress regulation, all of which could be relevant for displacement.
And the same story seems to hold for the basal ganglia, thalamus, and parietal cortex as well. Domestication appears to shape the anatomy and connectivity of these regions in ways that could potentiate the kinds of cognitive abilities central to displacement.
Right. So the researchers envision this positive feedback loop. Changes in brain regions like the hippocampus, driven by our self-domestication, enhance episodic memory and mental time travel. This in turn strengthens displacement in language and cognition more broadly. And this advanced capacity for displacement then further reinforces our social capacities and cultural evolution.
It's a beautifully integrated model that brings together neurobiology, psychology, and linguistics. And the authors even point to evidence from certain developmental disorders to bolster their case.
Absolutely. They discuss how conditions like Williams syndrome, autism, and schizophrenia, which involve dysfunction in the key brain regions they highlighted, present with deficits in both episodic memory and language, including impairments in the use of displacement.
That's a really compelling line of support. It suggests that when you disrupt the neural underpinnings of displacement, you see cascading effects on both memory and language abilities. Just reinforces how deeply intertwined these faculties are.
Definitely. This paper does an excellent job of painting a rich, interdisciplinary picture of how displacement might have evolved in our species. By tracing the neurobiological changes, especially in the context of human self-domestication, the authors offer a compelling account of how our capacity for mental time travel, episodic memory, and generative language emerged.
Absolutely. It's a sophisticated and nuanced exploration that blends cutting-edge research from diverse fields. The authors don't just present a static model, but describe a dynamic, feedback-driven process that encapsulates the complexity of language evolution. Really impressive work.
I couldn't agree more. This study is a prime example of how deeply intertwined our biological and cognitive capacities are, and how tracing those connections can shed light on what makes us uniquely human. Definitely a must-read for anyone fascinated by the evolution of language and mind.
Definitely. Thanks for joining us on this journey of discovery. I'm sure our listeners are as intrigued as we are by these insights into the origins of displacement. Be sure to check out the paper for yourself to dive even deeper into this compelling research.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep exploring the unexpected.
This is Jen and Tom, signing off. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself struggling to remember the last time you time traveled?
Or wishing you could just mentally teleport to your favorite vacation spot?
Well, have we got the product for you. Introducing Displacement Dynamics, the one-stop shop for all your displacement needs.
That's right. Using the latest breakthroughs in neuroscience and evolutionary psychology, we've developed a revolutionary line of products to boost your mental time travel and episodic memory.
From our patented hippocampal harmonizer to our thalamic temporal transporter, we're harnessing the power of your brain's key displacement hubs.
Displace yourself into the past, future, or complete fantasy with ease. Impress your friends as you recount vivid details of events that never even happened.
And for a limited time, get our parietal cortex compass, perfect for navigating the uncharted territories of your imagination.
Don't settle for a life stuck in the present. Unleash your inner displacement with Displacement Dynamics. Get yours today.
Displacement Dynamics. Unlocking the power of your mind, one neuron at a time. Here is a detailed podcast episode about the research paper Pretending Not to Know Reveals a Powerful Capacity for Self-Simulation. Welcome to the Illuminating Research Podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge studies to uncover their fascinating stories. I'm Tom, here with my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. In this episode, we'll be exploring a paper that sheds new light on our remarkable ability to pretend and deceive. The study is titled Pretending Not to Know Reveals a Powerful Capacity for Self-Simulation, and it was conducted by Matan Maza, Chas Firestone, and Ian Phillips.
This paper investigates a fundamental aspect of the human mind, our capacity for pretense and deception. As the authors point out, pretending ignorance is crucial in all sorts of real-world contexts, from diplomacy to personal relationships. To pull off an effective deception, we have to not only reason about others' mental states, but also accurately simulate how we would behave if we truly lacked certain knowledge.
That's such an intriguing concept. Pretense requires this two-part process: first, understanding what someone else believes, and then convincingly acting out what we would do if we shared that belief. The tricky part is, past research has shown that people often struggle with the second step, the self-simulation piece.
Exactly. Studies on the hindsight bias have revealed that our knowledge of the actual state of the world can distort our recollections of our past beliefs and perceptions. Even when we're explicitly instructed to overcome this bias, it remains stubbornly persistent. So how do people manage to pull off effective deceptions, if they have such a hard time accurately simulating their own ignorant mindset?
That's the fascinating question the researchers set out to investigate. They devised a clever set of experiments to peek inside this process of self-simulation during acts of pretense. The key was to have participants play interactive games where they had to pretend not to know information that was actually revealed to them.
Ah, I see. So they created a controlled environment to observe this self-simulation in action. Let's dive into the details of how they did this. The researchers had participants play two different games, Battleship and Hangman.
In the standard version of each game, players start off completely ignorant about the hidden information they need to uncover, the locations of ships on a grid, or the identity of a secret word. Their goal is to reveal this information as efficiently as possible through a series of guesses.
But the researchers added a twist. In addition to playing these normal games, participants also completed pretend versions, where they were explicitly shown the full solution from the start, the ship locations or the hidden word. However, their task was to then play as if they didn't have this knowledge, to convincingly simulate being in a state of ignorance.
That's a brilliant experimental design. By directly comparing players' decisions and behaviors in the normal versus pretend games, the researchers could assess how well people are able to model and mimic their own ignorant selves. So what did they find?
The results were quite remarkable. On the surface, the pretenders did an incredibly convincing job of mimicking the patterns of real, ignorant players. In Battleship, the number of guesses made by pretenders was statistically indistinguishable from non-pretenders. And in Hangman, pretenders' guess patterns closely matched the difficulty of the words they were trying to reveal, just as real players would.
Wow, that's really impressive. It suggests people have a deep, nuanced understanding of how their own minds work in a state of uncertainty. They're able to tap into an internal model of their decision-making processes and behaviors to enact a remarkably accurate simulation.
Absolutely. But the researchers didn't stop there. Using computational modeling, they were able to uncover some subtle differences between pretend and real play. Pretenders tended to exhibit a bit of overacting. Their decisions showed signs of being more stereotypical and simplified compared to genuine play.
Interesting. So even though the pretenders were able to fool human observers, the models could detect slight imperfections in their self-simulation. I imagine that's because the internal model people use for pretense has to be a simplified, schematic version of their actual cognitive processes.
Exactly. The researchers argue that this capacity for self-simulation, while remarkably sophisticated, still relies on a somewhat abstracted representation of our own decision-making. It's not a perfect replication, but rather a heuristic model that captures the key patterns and dynamics.
That makes a lot of sense. Modeling every nuance of our own cognition in real time would be computationally expensive and unnecessary for most everyday acts of pretense. Instead, we seem to have developed a more efficient, high-level simulation that allows us to convincingly play the part when needed.
Precisely. And the researchers see this as opening up an exciting new window into the nature of our metacognitive knowledge, our understanding of our own thought processes. Pretense provides a unique way to probe this self-model, beyond just relying on people's explicit introspections.
That's a really valuable contribution. By studying how people simulate their own ignorance, we can gain deeper insights into the implicit, structural knowledge we have about ourselves. It's a powerful approach for illuminating the rich inner workings of the human mind.
Absolutely. This paper demonstrates our remarkable capacity for self-simulation, but also reveals its limitations and the schematic nature of our self-models. It's a fascinating glimpse into the cognitive machinery that allows us to so seamlessly engage in acts of pretense and deception.
Well said. This was a really intriguing study that sheds new light on a core aspect of human cognition. I'm left wondering about the broader implications. How might this self-simulation capacity evolve and develop across the lifespan? And could insights from this research be applied to better understand disorders involving difficulties with social cognition and theory of mind?
Great questions. There's certainly a lot more to explore here. This paper has opened up an exciting new avenue for studying the metacognitive underpinnings of our social and imaginative capacities. I can't wait to see what future research uncovers about the depth and flexibility of our ability to pretend and deceive.
Me too. This was a truly illuminating discussion. Thank you all for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive into the science of self-simulation. Be sure to check out the full research paper and let us know what you think. Until next time, I'm Jen.
And I'm Tom. Thanks for listening to Illuminating Research. Are you feeling the need to deceive, but lack the self-simulation skills to pull it off convincingly?
Introducing SimuSelf, the revolutionary new app that uses the latest metacognitive research to help you perfect your pretense.
With SimuSelf, you can train your mind to seamlessly mimic any state of ignorance or false belief. Tap into your inner model of decision-making to become a master of deception.
Whether you need to convince your boss you didn't know about the big project, or trick your friends into believing you lost your keys, SimuSelf has you covered.
Our advanced AI algorithms analyze your thought patterns to generate custom scripts and behaviors. Practice makes perfect. Soon you'll be deceiving even yourself.
SimuSelf, the app that reveals your true capacity for self-simulation. Download it now and start your journey to becoming a world-class pretender.
Disclaimer. SimuSelf should not be used to actually deceive anyone. That would be unethical, but it's great for improving your acting skills.
So what are you waiting for? Get SimuSelf today and tap into the power of self-simulation. Available on the App Store and Google Play.
Here is the informative, entertaining, and very detailed podcast episode about the research paper Active Inference and Speech Motor Control, a review and theory, intro. Welcome to the Cognition Chronicles, the podcast that delves into cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. Today, we're excited to dive into a fascinating paper that explores the connection between active inference and speech motor control. This is a topic that has huge implications for how we understand the complex interplay between perception and action.
That's right, Jen. The paper is titled Active Inference and Speech Motor Control, a review and theory, and it's authored by Abigail R. Bradshaw, Claire Press, and Matthew H. Davis. By the end of this episode, you'll have a deep understanding of how this innovative theoretical framework can shed new light on the sensorimotor mechanisms underlying speech production.
This is really cutting-edge stuff, Tom. Active inference is a domain general theory of brain functioning that reconceptualizes the perception-action interface. Rather than treating perception and action as distinct processes, active inference proposes they arise from a common process of minimizing sensory prediction errors. It's a radical shift in how we think about the brain's inner workings.
Exactly. And as the authors point out, while active inference has been extensively applied to the control of manual action guided by visual feedback, it's received relatively little attention when it comes to speech motor control. That's what makes this paper so important. It provides the first detailed application of an active inference framework to auditorily guided speech production.
This is a critical test case for active inference theory. If it can successfully account for the sensory-motor mechanisms underlying speech, it would be a major validation of the framework and open up exciting new avenues for research. Let's dive in and see how the authors make their case. Intro, body.
Okay. Let's start by looking at the core premise of active inference. The authors explain that in this framework, both perception and action are seen as arising from a common process of prediction error minimization. In the context of speech, this means that speech production isn't just about executing pre-planned motor commands, but rather, dynamically adjusting those commands based on predictions about the expected sensory consequences.
Right. The key idea is that the brain is constantly generating predictions about the sensory feedback it expects to receive during speech, and then using any discrepancies between those predictions and the actual feedback to update and refine the motor commands. It's a constant back and forth between perception and action, all guided by this overarching drive to minimize prediction errors.
Exactly. And the authors explain how this contrasts with traditional models of speech motor control, which have tended to focus more on feedforward versus feedback control mechanisms. In those models, speech production involves either pre-planned motor commands executed without online sensory feedback, or online adjustments based on real-time comparisons of predicted and actual sensory input.
But the active inference framework offers a more unified view. It suggests that both of those control modes, feed forward and feedback, actually arise from the same underlying process of prediction error minimization. The brain is constantly trying to minimize those prediction errors, whether that involves updating its motor plans or adjusting its sensory predictions.
Right. And the authors highlight some key differences in the computational architecture of active inference models compared to traditional speech motor control frameworks. For example, active inference proposes a tight integration between sensory and motor representations, with the same generative model used to make both perceptual and motor predictions.
That's a really important point. In active inference, perception and action aren't separate processes. They're part of a unified system that's all about optimizing the brain's internal model of the world. The motor system isn't just executing pre-planned commands, but is actively trying to change sensory input to match its predictions.
Exactly. And the authors suggest this could have some fascinating implications for understanding speech-motor learning and adaptation. For instance, they propose that proprioceptive feedback, information about the position and movement of the articulators, may play a more central role in speech-motor learning than previous models have accounted for.
That's really interesting. The traditional focus has been on auditory feedback, but the active inference view suggests proprioception could be just as crucial for updating the brain's internal model of speech production. It opens up new avenues for investigating the sensory mechanisms underlying speech-motor adaptation.
Absolutely. And the authors go on to present a specific active inference account of how speech-motor compensation and adaptation unfold in response to auditory feedback perturbations. They describe how the brain generates predictions about the expected auditory consequences of speech, and then uses any resulting prediction errors to trigger rapid compensatory adjustments in motor commands.
That's a really elegant and intuitive explanation. Rather than just reactively correcting errors, the brain is proactively trying to minimize those prediction errors through dynamic adjustments to the motor plan. It's a much more sophisticated and flexible model of sensory motor control.
Exactly. And the authors suggest this active inference framework could even shed light on phenomena like phonetic convergence, where speakers' productions start to align with those of their conversation partners. The idea is that the brain is actively trying to minimize prediction errors not just based on its own previous productions, but also the predicted auditory feedback of the other speaker's voice.
Wow, that's really fascinating. It takes this notion of prediction error minimization and applies it not just to the individual's own speech, but to the social dynamics of language use. It's a powerful unifying theory that could have implications across a wide range of speech and language phenomena.
Absolutely. The authors really make a compelling case that active inference provides a rich theoretical framework for understanding the sensorimotor underpinnings of speech production. By bridging the gap between predictive coding accounts and traditional models of speech-motor control, it opens up exciting new avenues for empirical investigation and theoretical advancement.
I'm really excited to see how this line of research develops. The active inference approach seems to offer a much richer and more nuanced view of the perception-action interface in speech, with the potential to shed light on all sorts of complex behaviors. This is definitely a paper that's going to stimulate a lot of new thinking and experimentation in the field. Body, reflections.
You know, one of the things that really struck me about this paper is how it challenges some of the core assumptions of traditional speech-motor control models. The idea that perception and action are fundamentally separate processes, that speech production is just about executing pre-planned motor commands, the active inference framework really upends all of that.
Definitely. I was particularly intrigued by the suggestion that proprioceptive feedback might play a more central role than we've appreciated before. That really makes you rethink how the sensory and motor systems are interacting during speech. And the potential implications for speech-motor learning and adaptation are quite profound.
Absolutely. If proprioception is that crucial, it means we need to be looking at a much more integrated sensorimotor system. One where the brain is constantly anticipating and adjusting based on multiple sensory modalities. It's a level of sophistication that goes beyond just auditory error correction.
Yeah, and I think that's where the real power of the active inference framework lies, in its ability to capture that integrated, dynamic interplay between perception and action. Rather than treating them as separate processes, it says they're fundamentally part of the same overarching computation.
Exactly. And I like how the authors acknowledge that there may be some theoretical differences between active inference and existing speech motor control models, even if they use similar terminology. That nuance is important. We can't just assume these frameworks are saying the same thing, even if there are surface-level similarities.
Definitely. That's a really crucial point. The authors are careful to map out the specific architectural differences and how those might lead to different predictions and hypotheses. That kind of conceptual clarity is so important, especially when you're trying to integrate a new theoretical framework like this.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the real strengths of this paper. It doesn't just lay out the active inference account, but it directly considers how it relates to and potentially diverges from existing models. That sets the stage for really productive empirical tests and continued theoretical refinement.
Definitely. This is the kind of paper that I think is going to spark a lot of important conversations and new research directions in the field of speech motor control. It's taking a bold, integrative theoretical approach, but doing so in a way that's grounded in the existing literature and open to empirical scrutiny. Really impressive work. Reflections. Conclusion.
In summary, this paper makes a strong case for applying an active inference framework to the sensorimotor mechanisms underlying speech production. By reconceptualizing perception and action as a unified process of prediction error minimization, it offers a rich theoretical account that challenges some of the core assumptions of traditional speech motor control models.
Absolutely. The authors highlight how active inference could help explain key phenomena like speech motor adaptation, compensation, and even phonetic convergence. And they identify important areas, like the potential role of proprioceptive feedback, where active inference generates novel hypotheses for future empirical investigation.
Exactly. This paper doesn't just present a new theoretical framework. It lays the groundwork for a whole research program that could significantly advance our understanding of the sensorimotor underpinnings of speech. It's a really exciting development in the field, and one that I think is going to generate a lot of important new work in the years to come.
I couldn't agree more. Active inference provides a powerful lens through which to re-examine the perception-action interface in speech, with the potential to unify and extend our existing models in really profound ways. This is a must-read paper for anyone interested in speech, sensorimotor control, or the broader implications of predictive coding for human cognition.
Definitely. Thanks for joining me today, Jen. I'm sure our listeners are as intrigued by this work as we are. Be sure to tune in next time as we dive into another cutting-edge research paper that's pushing the boundaries of what we know. Until then, keep exploring the fascinating frontiers of the mind.
Absolutely, Tom. This has been a great discussion. Catch you next time, everyone. Conclusion.
Do you ever feel like your speech just isn't sounding as crisp and clear as you'd like?
Are you tired of constantly having to adjust your mouth and tongue to get the right sounds to come out? Well, have we got the solution for you?
Introducing SpeechSync, the world's first active inference-powered speech enhancement system.
SpeechSync uses advanced predictive coding algorithms to seamlessly align your motor commands with the expected auditory feedback, ensuring your words come out smooth, natural, and also satisfying.
No more clunky, robotic-sounding speech. SpeechSync dynamically adjusts your articulator movements in real time to minimize those pesky prediction errors.
And the best part? SpeechSync works for all your speech needs, whether you're giving a presentation, flirting at a party, or even engaging in some after-hours verbal activities.
That's right. SpeechSync will have you speaking with the confidence and clarity of a professional voice actor. Just plug in, sync up, and let the smooth, silky sounds flow.
So what are you waiting for? Get SpeechSync today and start optimizing your speech production for maximum prediction error minimization.
SpeechSync. Unleash your inner Morgan Freeman.
SpeechSync, because sometimes you just need to shut up and take our money.